right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a very packed show today, so I'm just going to jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be hearing from Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he's going to be talking to us about the presidential audition going to AIPAC, tightening up a special relationship to enforce a world of oppression. That's an article he wrote recently on revcom.us. And we're also going to be talking with Sari Makdisi, a professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. And we're going to be talking with Sari about the UC Regents' installation of a whole new set of principles against intolerance, which actually then includes opposition to anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism, which basically, as Sari says, creates a catastrophic situation. And it's yet another attack on all those who would stand up against occupation of Palestine and oppression of the Palestinian people. And opening the show up, we're going to be hearing an interview I did with Jeffrey Brown, the director, and Jane Charles, the producer of Sold, a remarkable and powerful new film about child sex trafficking. So here's my interview with Jeffrey and Jane. I recently had the opportunity to see a film that just knocked me back in a way that I haven't been knocked back in a long time. And it's a film that really, it was very visceral. It really just hit you. It hit you in your heart. It hit you in your brain. It was a hard film to watch, but it was one you couldn't move away from after you had started watching it. And the film is called Sold, and it's about a young woman who is sold into sexual slavery from Nepal, and she's sold into sexual slavery in India. But before I say anything more about it, I want to welcome to the show the director of the film, Jeffrey Brown. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. Sure. It's great to be on with you.
And the producer of the movie, Jane Charles. Jane, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
Sure. Why don't we start with you, Jeffrey? Why don't you tell us what the story is about more than what I said?
Our film is an adaptation of a novel written by Patricia McCormick. It's a novel by the same title. It's called Sold. It was written for a youth audience, and it's been translated into 32 languages. So it's frequently the entry point for young people to find out about the issue of modern-day slavery in our world today. It's an amazing book. It's very poetic and very beautifully written. And when we read it, we optioned it immediately and saw the film as we were reading it and knew that this would be a kind of clarion call to everybody to end child trafficking. The global average age of a trafficked child is 13 years old, which is an astounding fact. And that is the age of our heroine in the film. And I think that's one of the reasons it's both difficult to watch and also inspirational to watch, because the girl that plays the lead is phenomenal talent. And so the film is filled with sort of her child's point of view going through this arduous ordeal.
Jane, what drew you to this story?
Well, Jeffrey read the book first. He had actually a couple of people bring it to him and called me, and he said, "You have to read this book. I think you'll really resonate with this story." And so I read it too. And when you read this book, which is an international bestseller by Patricia McCormick, it's been translated into 32 languages. And it's a young adult novel, and it's told through the eyes of this one young girl, Lakshmi. And it's so beautifully written, and it is a difficult subject, but Patricia made it very readable, very able to help us understand what it's like for this one young girl to be trafficked. And it tore me apart. I didn't know anything about trafficking at the time. I had traveled to India, knew about red light areas in India, had seen Born into Brothels and The Day My God Died, but I didn't know really what this life was like or that this is a $150 billion business. So I just said, I'm in, whatever it takes to make this film. It's now been almost 9 years since that day. And it's been quite the journey, and we're not going to end anytime soon.
Now, Jeffrey, one of the things that I kept thinking about as I was watching it was that to direct a film like this, there's something that has to hit you both in the intellectual level that you were talking about, but then also on a very visceral level, because this is something that is so widely known but unknown. People kind of turn their eyes in a different direction, and it doesn't get out there as much as, like, the trafficking in women is not like this is a major thing to talk about. It's actually oftentimes just sort of there but not there. I was wondering, was there something on both the visceral and the intellectual level that really said to you, look, I'm going to make this film and I'm going to make it this way?
Yeah, the power of the book is that you're really in this kid's shoes. You're seeing the world through her eyes. And you're in her head and in her heart as she goes through this. And I think that's what really appealed to me. You know, when you read statistics about trafficking, the International Labor Organization says there are 5.5 million children in labor and sex slavery today. You read another statistic from ECPAT, which is one of our partner organizations, and they say 1.8 million children are estimated to be trafficked every year into sexual slavery alone, the average age 13. These statistics are kind of astounding, but they don't really hit you in your heart. And this book, you know, I read it in one sitting, literally. I could not get up from the chair. I was laughing and crying and deeply moved. And I knew that this could be a clarion call to shed light on this issue. I'd been looking for something that would really bring world focus to help vulnerable kids. And I knew that trafficking was an issue that was much bigger than people knew it to be. So when I read the book, I knew this was what I'd been looking for. This was something that could change the world and help real kids who either were vulnerable to trafficking, you know, and we could protect them through education, or they had been trafficked and we could help heal them from PTSD and help vocationally train them so that they could have a life of freedom and a life free from fear. So these things all were sort of in play when I read the book. And I think because the book was so intimate, I saw the movie as I was reading it. And we really kept the movie from this girl's point of view as much as we possibly could. And I think that's the power of the film. I think, you know, it hits them in their heart and it stays with them. I've had people say, you know, I watched that movie 2 years ago and I still think about it all the time. You know? And those are the kind of things as a filmmaker that you really strive for. And I think I knew right away that the most critical choice to making this film work would be finding an amazing actor to play the lead and then surrounding her by amazing adults who are also sensitive to working with a young person. So we did a very full search for about 6 months in Nepal, India, and the U.S. for the lead. We saw about 1,000 kids. We had a great casting team in Mumbai, a woman named Tess Joseph and her staff, and they went to Nepal a couple times and went all over India. And she sent me 700 videos of kids. And when we saw the audition of Niar, we knew instantly. We were laughing and crying just like we were reading the book, and we knew we'd found her. And then finally we got to meet her in person, and it confirmed everything that we thought. And she is one of the big reasons the film is amazing.
Jane, let me ask you this. The young girl that you're talking about there and the character in the film, Lakshmi, she becomes a commodity. This is one of the things that gets really disturbed me, because you start and you look at her when she's home and there's just this free spirit, this young girl who's like just in life, she's actually very alive. And not that that ever really changes, but in terms of the conditions surrounding her. And yet she ends up being sold into a situation where she becomes a commodity in terms of her father saying, you know, we've got to sell her to this person so she can go and make money so that we'll be able to continue to live and this will be good for her. And not knowing it's a brothel, but then she gets to the brothel, she suddenly becomes a commodity to be bought and sold. How did that hit you? What was your take on that?
Well, it's shocking to see, and it's even more shocking when you meet the real survivors. When Jeffrey and I traveled around Nepal and India, and followed Patty McCormick's footsteps, met people at APMEAP and rescue facilities, a beautiful orphanage where there were some girls there, you see that these are still children. These are maybe 16-year-olds who had been in a brothel for 3 years already and were rescued. And you also see that their spirits are not broken. And I think that informed us a lot. We really wanted to get this situation right. We wanted it to be accurate. We wanted people to see that these are real girls. This is not something that just happens over there. It happens in almost every country in the world. And it's something that is a gender equality and a economic issue, which we show in the film. But it's also, we need to understand that once these girls and boys are rescued and are in somewhere safe, they need to be healed because they went through a horrible situation, and there's healing and work to be done with them, you know, services that need to be provided no matter where they've come from. But they can be healed. There's hope to this issue. There are services out there, and that's what we plan to do with the film, is support the rescue and recovery an educational and vocational training of these children, because really all of us have to protect our children in the world.
Jeffrey, let's talk a little bit more about this commodity situation. There's a line in the film, and I was watching it again this morning. There's a scene in the film where Lack hears this other young woman being beaten, and the woman who runs the brothel comes over and she yells at the guys and she says, "Never touch the faces. Faces are merchandise." And it really drove home to me this point about the commodification in the society at large, but also in particular in this brothel, from which they rarely ever get even outside more than going out on the roof or something.
Yeah, so there's a great quote that I heard. We recently had the honor of showing the trailer at the UN as part of a panel on artists and how we make change in human trafficking. And Ross Bleckner, who's the artist in residence at the UN, quoted the Dalai Lama, and he said, "People were created to be loved. Things were created to be used. The reason why the world is in such chaos is because things are being loved and people are being used." And I thought that just really summed up what you're talking about. And girls and boys who are very young are being commodified and sold as sexual slaves all over the world. And that's something that's just, it's one of the darkest things that is confronting our world. And when you think about 1.8 million children a year forced into this against their will, threatened, coerced, we've got to do something. This is a major human rights issue, which people are not really addressing yet. Resources have not been committed to it yet. Well, a lot of communities actually are starting to really pay attention and raise funds, faith-based communities. And we're really in a fortunate place. And as we released the film, we took a lot of time to release our film because we wanted major partnerships with major organizations so that we could bring the film to communities like Rotary Clubs or faith communities, congregations, churches, mosques, temples, and bring people into the issue and get them taking action on the issue, whether it's domestic or internationally. So we are partnered with Save the Children, World Vision, United Way Worldwide, Freedom Fund, UNODC, and many other organizations. We have partners like iRest Institute, which will bring healing to the girls, Build a Nest, which will bring vocational training to the young people who've been trafficked, both in Nepal and India. We have partners who are building schools to prevent kids being trafficked in Nepal. You know, the earthquake there destroyed 5,000 schools. One showing of Sold, we built 20 schools in Nepal, and we're hoping to build another 200 next spring. You know, what we need to do is address this in community en masse across the world.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Jeffrey Brown and Jane Charles, the director and producer of the film Sold. Jane, hitting back at this point about this commodification, it gets internalized by many of the women that are forced into this life, and you show that in the film. But there's something bigger that's sitting on top of this whole thing. You know, there's a point around the patriarchy, this whole big kind of cloud, this historic cloud that sits up there and is weighing down very heavily on the lives of women. And in a certain sense, it even determines a lot of what happens to women. Even before they're born, a lot of their future is laid out to them. Let's talk about that a little.
Sure. I mean, this is definitely a global issue that we have. You know, we have to raise the status of women and girls. And it's been proven that if you raise the status of women and girls in a country, that country does better economically. And this issue that we have, this demand issue that we have in prostitution, and especially in underage prostitution, is something that we're working with several organizations that are looking at this quite closely, because if there was no demand, there would be no issue. If there were no buyers, there would be no issue. This is an issue that is obviously cultural, it's community-based, it's something that has to start at a very early age everywhere, and education is key. Education is key to prevention, education is key to changing minds and changing hearts about this issue so that we really see it for what it is. And it is true that this patriarchy has to change. The world would be a better place if we really raise the status of all of our women and children.
I have just a couple more questions for you. In the film, Lakshmi never really resigns herself to the horror that she's forced to live. She sort of always is pushing at the edges of that, and without doing any kind of spoiler, she's never just sort of beaten so far down to the ground that she just becomes robotically going through this life of hell. You know, and I wanted to ask you, Jane, first again. I saw this quote from you. I thought it was very interesting. You said, "I think you gain power over the sadness of a story like this by being able to do something about it." And you've been talking about that. But what do you mean? Explain that a little bit more.
You know, when we're in action as people, when we actually become active in something, we are inspired, we are able to feel empowered, and that's what we want people to do when they see the film. This film, when people finish seeing the film, they want to do something right away, and we'll be giving people action items and things that they can do to help end trafficking. You know, we met so many survivors, and when you look at this as a big global issue and $150 billion business, it seems huge and insurmountable. But if you really break it down, if we all work together to end this, we really can make a difference. And I've seen it happen. And I'm so much more hopeful than even when we started that there are so many people that are paying attention to this now. If every one of us decided that this can't happen anymore, we would continue to create real change. And so I feel more hopeful. There was a lot of sadness when we were making the film, and I think Jeffrey and I both carried these survivors with us, and we think about these children all the time that are alone and in a room somewhere in the world, and how can we help them? But once you get active, you realize there are things you can do in this issue, and even just talking about it and making sure that the world sees that this is something we all just have to say no to. It just can't happen anymore. You know, there's power to action and just stepping forward and doing something.
Although, you know, it's interesting because when we also talk about this, and this is, I'll ask you first, then we can segue into Jeffrey. There's something that still keeps sitting with me, though, because we have a patriarchy that's been sort of this, you know, the shell of every form of society up to this point, except in the very earliest stages. Women have basically been screwed over one way or another. And this patriarchy that sits out there, and it's not just a product of one system or another, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, that there's really a systemic source of the problem in a certain sense, that just if you look at the situation of women in general, even before they're born, their future is somewhat determined by the way that these societies run.
Well, it's true, and there is a real issue, especially in Southeast Asia and in India in general, there over time, and I do think that there is change happening in India. We've seen that with the Delhi rapes and women rising up and saying no. But, you know, there's female infanticide. People in general haven't wanted to have female children because they have to get married, have a dowry in some cases, and are not seen as being able to support the family or going out to work.
I mean, to me, it really seems that there's got to be a revolutionary change in the world, in these societies, yes, but there's got to be something that really turns things upside down in a certain sense, or actually breaks through to a whole new way of people relating to one another. I'm always trying to wrestle with, how do we break that chain of even before they're born, their futures are often decided for them? And that's something I really like to wrestle with a whole lot, and have people come out of your film wrestling with, is how the hell do we change this? Change it for good, basically. How do we actually change it in a way that'll put things on a whole different road, a whole different trajectory?
The film is about a child being trafficked. And, you know, that is one of the most heinous things that's happening to women globally. But it's one of a long list of heinous things. You know, if you read Half the Sky, you'll get a snapshot of what's happening to women all over the world. And you'll become a radical feminist like me. And our film is, its real power is that it's about compassion. It's about doing this together. It's about embracing each other, creating a global human family, in which we realize, finally, that we're all interdependent. Our futures are interdependent, and we have to think globally and collectively and long-range, not just short-range profit.
The film, it's opening up in L.A. on April 8th, and then there's a whole series of places in the country that people can see it.
Yeah, so we made this film to be brought into communities. So it's going to be in 20 or 30 cities for a week-long theatrical run. But we're partnered with TUGG, T-U-G-G, which is a cinema on demand model, which means that wherever you live in the U.S., you can become the captain of a screening. And that screening can actually be to raise funds for the Taught Not Traffic campaign, which we'll distribute to grassroots NGOs on the ground in Nepal, India, and the U.S., or you can, you know, give to a partner organization of ours, or create your own screening for an organization that you love. The way Tug works is you go to our website, soldthemovie.com, and you click on screenings, and there's lots of information there on how to bring Soul to a theater near you, and we have a team that's in place that can help, you know, talk you through it. It's very simple. All you really have to do is invite your community, your friends, family, a Rotary Club, a church group, whatever organization you're working with, and you can then host a screening wherever you live, and Tug books the theater and does all the rest. And you can use it as a fundraiser or as a way to create more awareness about this issue, as a sort of conversation starter.
Absolutely. And Jane, anything else you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
Well, we do want to give people things that they can do. And the main thing people can do is see the film. Like Jeffrey said, go to soldthemovie.com. We also have a campaign where you can join the campaign by texting Sold, S-O-L-D, to 51555. And we'll be sending out text messages to let you know where Sold will be screening, and information about our partners and things that people can do. But we want people to get active, and we do hope that people will all see the film, because change only occurs when there's awareness, and awareness is key.
All right, and I have to add one more thing. You know what, folks? The film is a remarkably beautiful and powerful piece of art. All right. And it's really something that people need to see and need to spread around as much as possible, because it's dealing with one of the most critical questions in the world today. And it deals with it in a very beautiful, powerful, and moving way. So, Jeffrey and Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
Jane? Thanks so much, sure. Michael.
Okay. Take care now. Nice talking with you. All right. That was Jeffrey Brown, the director, and Jane Charles, the producer of Sold. And right now, I want to read a quotation from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that has everything to do with what we've just been talking with Jeffrey and Jane about. This is from his book, Basics. Look at all these beautiful children who are female in the world. And in addition to all the other outrages which I have referred to in terms of children throughout the slums and shantytowns of the third world, in addition to all the horrors that will be heaped on them, the actual living in garbage and human waste in the hundreds of millions as their fate laid out before them, yes, even before they are born, there is, on top of this, for those children who are born female, the horror of everything that this will bring simply because they are female in a world of male domination. And this is true not only in the third world. In modern countries like the U.S. as well, the statistics barely capture it. The millions who will be raped, the millions more who will be routinely demeaned, deceived, degraded, and all too often brutalized by those who are supposed to be their most intimate lovers. The way in which so many women will be shamed, hounded, and harassed if they seek to exercise reproductive rights through abortion or even birth control. The many who will be forced into prostitution and pornography, and all those who, if they do not have that particular fate, and even if they achieve some success in this new world where supposedly there are no barriers for women, will be surrounded on every side and insulted at every moment by a society and a culture which degrades women on the streets, in the schools and workplaces, in the home, on a daily basis, and in countless ways. Once again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from his book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And you can download a free electronic copy of Basics at revcom.us. So we're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be right back to talk with Sari Makdisi about the recent UC Regents decision to, to institute a whole new set of policies governing anti-Semitism and what they're calling anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back. All right. Welcome back. That was Witch Hunt from Francesco Berzati, and his album was This Machine Kills Fascists, all right? and it just seems so damn appropriate. Okay. All right. On March 23rd, the regents of the University of California approved new principles against intolerance, is what they call them. And they included opposition to anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism. And then we'll get into understanding what that's all about. And this is an attack on anyone, student or professor, who criticizes the state of Israel and its actions. And joining us now to talk about this, well, we're going to have two segments on this combined here. First, we're going to be talking with Sari Makdisi. Sari is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA, and he's the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And a little bit later, we'll be joined by Alan Goodman, a writer for Revolution newspaper, whose most recent article in Revolution is The Presidential Audition Goes to AIPAC, Tightening Up a Special Relationship to Enforce a World of Oppression. So I want to welcome Sari to the show. Sari, good to have you back, man, after a long spell.
Always good to be on, Michael.
Yeah, great, man. Well, let's jump into this, because I got so much to ask you. As I said, on the 23rd, they adopted this policy. The Board of Regents adopted a policy on what they say is intolerance, that in fact was a recipe for intolerance when it comes to criticizing Israel or fighting for Palestinian human rights. Can you give people an idea of what this policy is and why it needs to be opposed?
Yeah, I mean, the policy as it ended up being finally approved is actually not as bad as it could have been had there not been a lot of resistance to it by faculty, students, organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace and Palestinian activists and so forth. So I should back up a little bit and say that the policy is kind of the culmination of a few years of effort now on the part of people who defend Israel in the U.S. to try to equate in a blanket kind of way anti-Zionism, which is criticizing Zionist ideology and the state policies of the State of Israel, with anti-Semitism, which is, of course, hatred of the Jewish people. Of course, these are two totally distinct things, and the distinction is really important to always keep in mind. But what people who are defending Israel have been trying to do is to say that insofar as you are critical of the State of Israel or the policies of the State of Israel or the ideology of Zionism, you are therefore sort of ipso facto also, you hate the Jewish people and you're an anti-Semite in some way. So they're trying to taint, they've long been trying to taint criticism of Zionism as itself anti-Semitism. So they've been lobbying and pushing and hectoring and bellowing and doing all kinds of things to get not just the UC, but other university systems and indeed state legislatures. We should say, by the way, including the California state legislature, to try to collapse anti-Semitism into anti-Zionism and make them sort of irretrievable from each other. And so this is what they've been pushing for. So this doctrine that the regents have now embraced is one that's supposedly about all forms of intolerance. And of course, it goes without saying everybody should always oppose all forms of genuine intolerance, including actual anti-Semitism. But given the atmosphere on campus and in the country, given, for example, the explosion of Islamophobia and Islamophobic discourse politically and locally and regionally and on campuses as well, it's extraordinary that Islamophobia merits barely a mention. Other forms of bigotry, like in the atmosphere of Black Lives Matter and so forth, all of that barely mentioned is worthy of a mention. And what takes over is not just the discourse of anti-Semitism, but as I said, this peculiar conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. So what they were seeking was, in fact, a blanket conflation, that if you are critical of Zionism, you are therefore critical of Judaism or of, you know, you become an anti-Semite. Because of all the pushback they got, they actually had to retreat from that at least a little bit to say that anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism have no place at the University of California, which, of course, and the point of all this is, of course, anti-Semitism never did have a place at the university, nor should it. And so, in fact, I mean, the irony is, in fact, nothing really changes, because anyway, anti-Semitism shouldn't have had a place. And you could even go so far as to say, you know, that by carefully distinguishing anti-Zionism from anti-Semitism, the UC Regents actually made a, you know, certain kind of good step, although I think they did it for the wrong reasons. But at least they did make that distinction between anti-Zionism as such and anti-Semitism as such. They kind of carefully separated the one from the other, which is really important, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the beginning, they actually just said straight up, though. They said anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, right? And now they're saying that there's anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism that is what they included in the final thing. Right.
So the original draft, and by the way, it's important to also note that this stuff is all in the sort of preparatory material, not in the principles of against intolerance themselves. But yeah, in the original version of this, which they first issued a few weeks ago, not the one that they actually passed, mind you, it's important to note the difference. But in the original version, the document condemned anti-Semitism
anti-Zionism and other forms of intolerance. And because of all the resistance they received, they had to modify that to say anti-Semitism and specifically anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism, which is, of course, you know, itself anti-Semitism anyway. So in other words, nothing really has changed. That's, in a way, I'm trying to find the silver lining here, the good news. The good news is that they do distinguish between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, and they're merely saying that anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism shouldn't be allowed. Fine, I don't have an argument with that, except that the question is why, you know, what is the context of this sudden fascination that university administrations have with anti-Semitism? And the background here is this is, again, it's not just California, not just the UC, it's a nationally organized, not exactly movement, but sort of escalation, let's say, to make it seem as though there's this massive wave of anti-Semitic incidents across universities across the country, which simply isn't true. What there is an increase of is activism against Israeli racism and Israeli home demolitions and Israeli dispossession of the Palestinian people. That's not anti-Semitism. The point is, what they're trying to do is to say that if you oppose the Israeli demolition of Palestinian homes, if you oppose Israel expelling Palestinians from their homes, if you oppose racist ideology, if you oppose the segregation of housing and of educational systems, and so on and so forth, that makes you anti-Semitic. So, you know, which is, of course, absurd. But that's, that, you know, again, to try and find a silver lining here, the good news is that those who are trying to defend Israel in our country, their backs are to the wall, to the extent that they're clutching at straws. They're so desperate to find some way to discredit the principled, historically documented opposition to Zionist policy as practiced by the State of Israel that they're just reaching for anything at this point. So, yeah, that's where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because some of the things that actually have come out here, it's sort of there's a whole way that there appears to be a whole political machine behind this effort which does definitely have a program. They have a concrete program. And, you know, you can look at this thing even if you look at the political machine. I was telling my wife this morning, it was sort of like you're tempted to do an imitation of Marlon Brando in The Godfather when you hear about, the UC Regent Richard Bloom talking about his wife, Diane Feinstein, who's actually would be very upset and could cause trouble for the UC system if they didn't pass this resolution. So it was kind of, there is a whole political machine that has been in operation, but that also has stepped up to a degree, hasn't it?
Oh, it has. I mean, there's a massive political mobilization. There's massive institutional mobilization so that all of the organizations that are monitoring our campuses on behalf of Israel, and there are dozens of them, and they're extremely well-funded and very, very well-organized and so forth. But again, you see, one can look at that and say, wow, you know, they have this region or that region or this senator or that senator or this institution or this money or whatever. Wow, therefore they must be incredibly powerful. But actually, if you can step back and think about this, you know, with a certain sense of detachment, you think, actually, they're desperate, backs to the wall with all of this organization, with all of these institutional forms of backing, with all of this funding, because they're trying to fight an idea that they can't resist. And that's the point. Because what Palestinians and their supporters in the U.S. are calling for is very simple. It's equality. It's justice. One person, one vote. It's these kinds of principles. And they're trying to basically stop very, very simple Palestinian message, which is we want rights, we want justice, we want equality. And it takes this massive mobilization to try to stop it. And even then, they can't really stop it. So, in fact, part of this also is the recent and current mobilization of resources against BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, against Israel, which are modeled on the anti-apartheid, the South African anti-apartheid struggle of the 1970s and 80s. And, you know, to think that people like Hillary Clinton are basically trotted out to do their, you know, their mantra against BDS. In other words, to think that BDS has become a topic of political concern across the country is quite extraordinary, because BDS is promoted by small-scale grassroots activists, by student activists, by writers and newspapers and so forth. There isn't this massive, well-financed, orchestrated, institutionalized support for BDS. It's an idea, and the idea is spreading rapidly. It's incredibly persuasive, and it's persuasive not just to Palestinians, it's persuasive to people across the spectrum. It's increasingly persuasive to Jewish students on campus, many of whom are now supporting the move for BDS and who are disenchanted with you know, what Israel represents, you know, to the world. And that's quite an amazing feat that basically student activists, writers, intellectuals, activists, et cetera, you know, acting, there's no institutional presence for it. There's no real super institutional support and financing for it. But they've mobilized to such an extent that the opposition against the idea of BDS has now taken this extraordinary, well-financed and institutionalized and indoctrinated kind of setting. It's quite amazing, actually.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Saria Makdisi, who is a professor of English and Comparative Literature at UCLA and the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And we're talking about the UC Regents' recent adoption of what would you call it, Saria? It's a policy paper, an intolerance policy paper, apparently. And we're talking about what's really behind that, what's really involved with that. You make a point here where you say, actually, preempting any and all criticism of Israel, even a non-binding resolution that was before the California State Senate that parrots the UC policy, which is also based on the State Department policy, you said that suppressing criticism of Zionism on the campus is catastrophic censorship. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I mean, it is, because a campus should represent all points of view, and it should particularly represent points of view that have been winning academic and non-academic arguments. So in other words, if you back up again and go back, you know, 20, 30 years, there was a set of myths around Israel that were very successfully propagated, especially in the 1960s, 1970s in this country, that Israel was born in innocence and that it, you know, as soon as it declared its independence in its stage of infancy, suddenly it was beset by all the Arab armies who wanted to push them into the sea, and, you know, all this stuff and so forth and so on. All these myths around Israel and that it wants peace and all it wants is, you know, and it's the only democracy in a terrible region, blah, 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 all this stuff. So all these things have been systematically demolished at the level of argument for 20 or 30 years. Now, nobody believes this stuff anymore except the last few desperate people who are defending Israel at all costs, and as I said, whose backs are to the wall at this point because they've lost all the arguments. So having lost all the arguments, what they're trying to do is essentially to banish argument itself, to make it illegal to speak out, illegal to say the kinds of things I just said. That this is what they would like to do, is to censor and to silence and to eliminate any form of dissent and argument, and no matter how well documented, no matter how principled, et cetera, and to dismiss it all as worthy of censorship because it is anti-Semitic or intolerant or whatever. And part of what's at stake, Michael, which is actually interesting, is their attempt not only to suppress free speech, which is, you know, they're extraordinary about. We have to remember that they want to suppress free speech because they've lost the arguments at the level of free speech. So having lost the argument, they want to get rid of argument altogether. But the second extraordinary thing that they're doing is this, which I find fascinating as somebody who teaches English literature and English rhetoric, is they're trying to re-engineer words and sort of totally, you know, like Humpty Dumpty, turn words around and give them new meaning and effect. The discourse about anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism we just talked about. But another word that they've now latched onto, and they have for the past several years, is this word called tolerance and intolerance, of course, right? So what they're trying to do basically is to redefine terminology such that if you speak on behalf of Israel, you are tolerant, or what Israel represents is tolerance. And so if you criticize Israeli policy, you are ipso facto intolerant, right? So in other words, somebody who calls for Palestinian rights, that's intolerance. Somebody who says Palestinians should have the same rights as Israeli Jews, that's intolerance. Somebody who says you can't demolish people's houses and kick families out in the middle of the night and bulldoze their homes, that's intolerance. And then, well, what is tolerance at that point? Well, tolerance, among many other things, tolerance is the name of a museum on Pico Boulevard here in L.A. that's been for the past several years trying to build a museum, really a kind of shrine to Zionism, on the desecrated ruins of a Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem. They're trying this for the past several years. So if you step back and think, hang on, these guys are trying to build a museum of tolerance, as they call it, on the bulldozed remnants of a former, not even former, there are still bodies in there, a Muslim cemetery that was in use until 1948. And they want to call this thing a shrine to tolerance. I mean, this is really where we are now. If you put Kafka with with Borges, with Swift, they wouldn't be able to come up with something like this, but these guys have. That's where we are. So they've come up with this incredible perversion of terms that, you know, on the one hand is kind of fascinating, but on the other hand is also incredibly distasteful.
Mm-hmm. Now, Saria, I'm going to bring Alan Goodman on for a minute, and if you want to stay on, it'd be really good, and, you know, maybe, you know, comment a little bit later as we go on.
Sure.
And in particular, you know, it's important, I think, to be thinking about this in a certain sense. Like, when you're talking about the BDS, one of the things I discovered as I was researching for this was people like Bonnie Rice, the vice chair of the Board of Regents, arguing that students opposed to Israeli policies and those questioning the state's unequal treatment of non-Jews have fostered a dangerous environment for Jewish students. And she particularly targets the BDS movement as being responsible for fomenting this kind of dangerous situation. Then you have, what's his name, Judea Pearl, also arguing that anti-Semitism is inseparable from the BDS movement. And it's something to really keep in mind in terms of the kind of assault that's coming down on the campus and what they're trying to cut, you know, crush and what they're trying to promote. And Alan Goodman, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this, man. You just wrote an article that was very, very heavy in terms of the, you know, examining the fact that what we just saw over the last couple of weeks, all of the various presidential candidates doing an audition by going to AIPAC. And your name of your article that's in revcom.us this week is "The Presidential Audition Goes to AIPAC, Tightening Up a Special Relationship to Enforce a World of Oppression." And I wanted to ask you to begin with, what are you talking about here? What's going on with this AIPAC meeting?
Well, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee is, you know, a lobbying group, but as I point out in the article on Revolution at revcom.us, it's not your typical lobbying group. It's a lobbying group that represents the quote-unquote special relationship between Israel and the United States, which is branded by its defenders as a special relationship based on mutual values, which I would argue it actually is, given that both countries were built on violent terrorist ethnic cleansing and genocide, but also that Israel represents an outpost of democracy and enlightenment in the Middle East, and thus, this is, you know, this is how they work on people. I mean, I agree with Sari that Israel's actual role in the world has been increasingly exposed in important, very inspiring and important ways, especially on campuses, but the empire is striking back. And that was very virulent at the AIPAC convention this year. This is something that traditionally every candidate for president goes to or makes a presentation to, and they did this year. I'll get the Bernie Sanders who didn't go a bit later, but everyone went. Hillary Clinton used her appearance there to attack the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, to portray it as being bullied on campuses, which I think Suri has spoken to, you know, how words get turned upside down very effectively, but that's what happened there. So all the candidates went to AIPAC. Their speeches got major coverage. And a couple of things. One is what they said tells you what you are complicit in if you get involved in the system's elections. And number two, it was very ominous in terms of the rulers of this country feeling that even as Israel is increasingly exposed for what it's doing to the Palestinians, the massacres it periodically carries out in Gaza, even as that's going on, they need Israel. And that was the other theme of this. Israel has historically played a major role. These endless wars Israel wages against its neighbors are not just defending Israel. They're also in the interests of the U.S., the military aid that Israel gave South Africa during the apartheid era, the role of Israel in the massacre of Guatemalan peasants and rebels in the early 1980s. Israel has served as a hitman for the U.S. empire, and I think today, when the U.S. is going up against reactionary Islamic fundamentalist jihad, Israel plays an important role as an ideological weapon in that conflict. We have extensive coverage of Israel in this issue of Revolution at revcom.us, including an article, Hillary Clinton Declares War on BDS, which quoted an article that Suri wrote, an op-ed piece, "Does the term apartheid fit Israel? Of course it does." And I went back to Cerie's original article, and I noted that he quoted Senator Barbara Boxer saying, "Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and any linkage between Israel and apartheid is nonsensical and ridiculous." And I thought to myself, well, for one thing, the actual apartheid regime in South Africa was a democracy. That doesn't tell you anything about the nature of Israel. But this is a way to get people to think like Americans and to identify with the interests of an empire that rules over a world where people are, you know, women are exploited in sweatshops in Bangladesh and China, and people are dying in civil wars in Congo to see who's going to exploit the miners there, and that patrols the inner cities of the United States killing black people. So that is what you are getting enlisted in when you get behind Israel, and that's what every one of the candidates was doing when they went to APEC. And I, you know, I quote them. Donald Trump said, "Israel does not pay its children to stab random Palestinians." Well, why is it okay for Israel to pay its soldiers to carry out mass murder against Palestinian children? You know, there were over 500 children murdered in homes and schools in UN shelters during the 2014 massacre in Gaza. And so the APEC appearance, I guess you could make three points. One, it was a major ideological counteroffensive against the kind of work that the Cerie was talking about to expose the actual nature of Israel. It was an expression of what you're getting if you enter into the electoral process with the in this system's elections. And I think it revealed something about how badly the United States and its empire need Israel as a model of democracy. You know, one of the things that I thought was particularly insidious was when Hillary Clinton said, we look at the Pride Parade in Tel Aviv, one of the biggest and most prominent in the world, and we marvel that such a bastion of liberty exists in a region so plagued by intolerance. See, that's how they work on you, to think that when you're, they bring you in on, tolerance, as Cerie was talking about, and then you're supposed to forget about the actual nature of Israel, what it was built on, what role it plays in the world.
All right, Alan, we have about 10 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we actually get to cover a couple things. One is Bernie, because I know a lot of people are looking at it and saying, you can talk about Trump, you can talk about Hillary, and Bernie goes, actually sends his message to AIPAC. It's not like he just said, oh, to hell with it, I'm not going to bother with these people because they're reactionary pigs. He said, no, I'm going to send something. Now, why even him?
Well, his presentation did come across as if it was different. He appeared to distinguish himself from the other candidates. He did send the message instead of appearing live in person. But the essence of his criticisms of Israel are how to strengthen the U.S.-Israel alliance. And I think, first of all, if you just really read his presentation, and we do kind of break it down in the article I wrote at revolution@revcom.us, but if you read it, you'll see it's basically advice to Israel on how to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship and everything it represents in the world. But I also made the point that, as Bernie Sanders evolves from activist mayor to senator and as a candidate for president of the United States, his positions on Israel have evolved in conformity with the needs of the empire. In 2014, when Israel was unleashing a one-sided killing spree against the people of Gaza, Sanders voted for the Senate resolution supporting, and I quote, "the state of Israel as it defends itself against unprovoked rocket attacks from the Hamas terrorist organization." The Senate voted 100-0 for that, and Bernie Sanders defended that as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me go on to this because I want to try to squeeze in as much as we can. You began to speak to this and the points that you were just raising in terms of what was involved with all the stuff going to AIPAC. But there's also something you mentioned in the article that I think it's important for people to see, is that there's a certain amount of contradictions that the U.S. is facing in this relationship with Israel in that region of the world. There's certain needs, necessities that they face, but there's also the rock bottom need they have to maintain that relationship and support Israel all the way. Let's talk about some of those contradictions and what's involved in terms of that.
Well, I think if you look at the history of Israel, particularly since 1967, and we won't go into it, but you'll see that its role in the world has evolved in concert with the objectives of the U.S. imperialism. During the Cold War, it played a certain role. I referenced South Africa and Guatemala, which were part of that whole conflict. Today, there's this conflict between reactionary Islamic fundamentalist jihad, which, while reactionary, does pose a serious threat to the U.S. empire in places like Syria and Iraq. And, of course, it's terrible, but it's evolved into a global confrontation, as we saw in Brussels. And then, so on the one hand, the U.S. has to work with and through reactionary regimes in the region in societies that have a large percentage of Muslim people and in societies where there's a lot of legitimate anger at Israel. So you have Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen. You have Turkey playing a key role for the U.S., or at least the U.S. would like Turkey to play a key role in terms of its objectives in Syria and Iraq. And those countries, if you remember, it wasn't that long ago that Israel attacked a Turkish ship carrying supplies to Gaza and murdered five people on board the Mavi Marmara. So these are real contradictions for the U.S. empire and the U.S.'s support for Israel, and they were kind of concentrated in that clash over the Mavi Marmara several years ago. But then you also have the fact that the U.S. doesn't have an ally anywhere near as reliable as Israel, with its West European standard of living built on the bones of the Palestinian people, with its huge nuclear arsenal, with its relatively stable section of Israeli citizens who do support Zionism. And also, and I think this gets back to what I was bringing up at the beginning, it's a model of, you know, Hillary Clinton can make the obscene claim that a gay pride parade in Tel Aviv justifies all these crimes that Israel is carrying out against the Palestinian people and U.S. backing for them in a way that she couldn't about Saudi Arabia, just to take an example. So, you know, Israel is just an indispensable element, even as there is conflict there. These are real contradictions this system is up against. And here I would really point to listeners who are thinking there's got to be another way besides Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalist jihad, and Western imperialism. That other way is a real revolution, as envisioned in this day and age in Babakian's new synthesis of communism. And you can get connected to that at revcom.us as well. So, but none of us can buy into the, you know, we are, you know, Israel as an outpost of freedom and democracy. When some ruling class politician comes talking to you about democracy, you know, to paraphrase Avakian, that's, you know, that talk is meaningless and worse. And just to get scientific and to quote from BA in basics, he says, the essence of what exists in the U.S. is not democracy, but capitalism, imperialism, and political structures to enforce that capitalism, imperialism. What the U.S. spreads around the world is not democracy, but imperialism and political structures to enforce that imperialism. And Israel plays it. That is the essence of the special relationship between Israel and the United States. Not that they're both democracies and you can have a gay pride parade in both countries. Mm-hmm.
All right, Alan, I want to thank you very much. I want to let Sari. Sari, do you have anything you'd like to add at the end of all this?
Oh, just quickly. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what Alan said makes sense, especially, you know, the spectacle of presidential candidates kowtowing before AIPAC, which is, you know, shocking and depressing and outrageous and all the rest of it. But I think that there's a point here that we need to also keep sight of. And again, it's sort of like sort of same kind of silver lining that one could look for in the struggles on campus, which is the fact that the U.S.-Israel relationship is actually now, at any rate, you know, in the Cold War, it was different, I think, to a certain extent. But today, I don't think Israel serves any purpose whatsoever to the U.S. I think it's actually it's a burden. It's a weight. It's a burden. It's not helping the U.S. at all. I think it's actually contrary to American interests, in fact, in all kinds of ways. So, again, this all the stuff that we hear about shared values and special relationship and all the rest of it, if you think about it for a second, I mean, no matter how flawed the U.S. is, and it is, as we know, at least in principle, on paper, there's a separation of church and state. There is equality before the law. There is, segregation is illegal. And again, we know this is at least, it's flawed in all kinds of ways. It's not applied perfectly, obviously. But at least formally, legally, that is what's true in the U.S. In Israel, all those things are exactly the opposite. There is no separation of church and state, or synagogue and state. There is no equality before the law. Palestinian citizens of the state are not treated the same juridically, institutionally, legally as Jewish citizens of the state, never mind the occupied territories. And there is formalized segregation in housing and education and other things as well. So this idea that there's something in common between the U.S. and Israel at those kinds of levels is simply absurd. And it takes this massive circus. Again, like on campus, well-funded, powerful institutional, et cetera, to keep the emperor's clothes on. But in fact, I think we're beginning to get to the point now. Trump, for all his insanity, he actually, at some points early in the campaign, did kind of speak a certain kind of truth about, well, what's in this for us, speaking as an American, right? And Bernie, to a certain extent, in a different way, I think, has been raising the same question recently. The question is, does the emperor still have his clothes, or what does it take for people to keep on believing in this absurd set of mantras that are increasingly discredited?
We have to wrap it up real quick.
So, I mean, that's what I want to say, is that there is a way to see a good side.
All right, Alan, anything in 10 seconds?
Yeah, these are important questions to continue to dig into. Every single candidate for president went to AIPAC and said, this is a model of democracy that is in our interest, and I think we rather than argue about whether or not it's in the interests of America, I would argue for not looking at the world from the interests of Americans and to stop looking at the world, because that is the biggest contradiction is between that and the interests of humanity. But I did also want to appreciate the work and exposure that Cerie's doing, and again, we did. We do have significant coverage of both the AIPAC incident and the war on BDS at revcom.us. So
all right, and we will have you both back on to continue this conversation. Actually, it's kind of interesting. I'd like to do that. All right, Alan, thank you very much. Cerie, thank you very much.
Anytime.
All right, bye now. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests Jeffrey Brown and Jane Charles, two of the creators of Sold, and Cerie McDeesey and Alan Goodman. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Alex Brenner, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me or volunteer to work on the show, which you can do from anywhere in the world, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Let Freedom Reign from Count Ozzy and the Mystic Revelations. Talk to you next week.